Good evening, my friends. It's the 27th of August, 2011, and you are listening to Truth News Radio Australia, brought to you by Herowood Fenton. That's me. And tonight, I'm bringing you an interview in about 12 minutes with a fascinating character from the UK who's actually here to give us a conference to present his information at a conference in Melbourne. And his name's Ian Crane. And he's got some insights to bring to geopolitics and oil, the myth of peak oil, and a few other important insights about what's going on the planet. And I'm looking forward to speaking to him shortly. But before doing that, I want to run through a few things that are in the news at the moment. I just want to quickly point out that people in Japan are suffering greatly as a result of the tsunami, earthquake, and radiation hazards. And there is a charity drive which has been actually spearheaded by my brother, Tom Fenton Kerr, who has launched a charity drive from Macquarie University, where he works. Macquarie University, Japan, We Are With You fundraiser event to be held on Wednesday, August the 31st, 2011. And you can find out all about that on our site and hopefully send some money to help some of the people. This particular charity drive is aimed at helping people who've got disabilities, people who've actually are blind or are disabled in some way, and they've suffered tremendously. You know, obviously their difficulties are much worse than even the horrendous problems that ordinary people are facing. And I want to just, on the theme of Japan, play you a clip from a recent interview with Christopher Busby on Russia Today, in which he presents some pretty, you know, continuingly alarming information. Of course, it's been alarming ever since the earthquake, and Christopher Busby has pointed out in other interviews that, in fact, the earthquake did most of the damage. It wasn't so much the tsunami that destroyed the reactors, which again points out the incredible the incredible danger and risk associated with these reactors. We were told that there was this terribly unforeseen event of the tsunami breaching the seawalls, and it turns out, although this has been really, you know, hush hush, that that actually the earthquake did most of that damage. But in this interview with Russia Today, Christopher Busby goes into some of the problems that are happening right now.
Now, reports suggest that the reactors at the Fukushima plant were damaged by the initial earthquake and not the tsunami wave. Well, given that earthquakes are commonplace in Japan, what does this say about the safety of the rest of Japan's nuclear reactors?
Well, I mean, the obvious response is that they should actually all be shut down. I think most people believe this. And they also believe that it was very silly to build reactors on what is clearly a fault line and in an area where there are known to be earthquakes. And now we see the result of having done that. I mean, this is the obvious response.
Well, in the wake of these reports, what should happen now, in your opinion, to Japan's network of nuclear facilities?
Well, in my opinion, of course, they should all be put into cold shutdown. I mean, and Japan should ultimately give up nuclear power. In fact, well, as you probably know, my opinion is nuclear power itself is an extremely dangerous process, and that you cannot really believe that you can cage these things and expect them not to come out, you know, not to have these sorts of accidents. And other accidents will occur in the future. And these accidents are so terrifying and the consequences of them are so appalling that really we cannot afford to choose this method of generating electricity. Of course, you can't stop it just now because that would bring the whole of Japan to a halt.
Okay, I'm going to have to pause it there. I don't have time to play the whole clip, but it's a really interesting an important analysis that he gives there. And obviously the situation in Fukushima has not improved. They don't really have a solution. The problem is really so extreme that there are no known solutions to fix the problem. And just to summarize it, as I understand it, you've got a choice between potentially covering everything up, for example, like what they did with Chernobyl, where they put a giant dome over it and filled that full of sand and cement. But of course, by doing that, when there's so much fissile material in there, the heat and the pressure is going to build up and possibly could lead to an explosion. In Chernobyl, it was possible to do that because most of the fissile material had already dispersed into the environment. Now, the other alternative, of course, is to just keep it cool and allow it to be exposed to the atmosphere and put water on it. And of course, by doing that, you'll keep it cool and you'll stop a runaway reaction, but you'll be continually leaking the radiation into the atmosphere, just endlessly. It'll just keep leaking into the atmosphere and into the water supply, because there is so much water going in to keep it cool, and all that water is coming back out and actually going into the ocean. So it is a totally, totally shocking situation there. Now, I just want to move to one other story for today. There's been another extraordinary media hit piece on the 9/11 truth movement, led by the venerable NPR organization, National Public Radio in America, which certainly, you know, comes across as being this very prestigious, very respectable media organization that, you know, they don't have advertising. It's publicly funded. And one would expect some level of integrity, some level of journalistic integrity in terms of what they do. And in the past, they did quite a reasonable interview with Dylan Avery, who was the creator of the film Loose Change. And they gave him a reasonably good shake. But now in the lead up to the September 11, 10th anniversary, what we're seeing is just a really crude attempt to slam the lid down on any questions about September 11, and any of the really important and credible scientific people are just being shut down. And this particular piece is a classic example of that. They consisted of mainly two people speaking through the hour-long piece, which was James Meggs, of course, of Popular Mechanics, and Jonathan Kay, who recently wrote a book called Among the Truthers. Both total propagandists, both completely loose with the truth, willing to ignore things that don't fit in with their view, and willing to totally misrepresent what 9/11 truthers have to say. And they allowed Kevin Ryan, who's one of the best spokesmen from the scientific perspective on 9/11, to come on, but they only had him on for less than 5 minutes, and they sort of cut him off as they were going to a break. And I'm going to play to you a short segment from it that features Jonathan Kay, and really, this speaks for itself. I hardly need to say more. I mean, it's just drivel. But here we go.
Right now, I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me from Paris, France, is Jonathan Kay. He's a comment page editor and a columnist at Canada's National Post. He's author of Among the Truthers, A Journey Through America's Growing Conspiracist Underground. Jonathan Kay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a world of Oliver Stone movies and episodes of The X-Files, why do you think these conspiracy theories are so appealing today?
Conspiracy theories are theories of evil. And humans have always been interested in why bad things happen to good people. Religions supply this answer, but we live in what for some is a post-religious age. And conspiracy theories supply the answer that religion once did. They explain why bad things happen. And as James said, it could be, you know, because of the Bilderbergers or the New World Order or Israel. Take your pick. Most conspiracy theories are interchangeable in terms of their structure.
And what about 9/11 makes it particularly prone to these kinds of conspiracy theories?
Well, conspiracy theories have always flourished in traumatized societies. If you look at modern conspiracist culture, It really originates to the French Revolution. After the French Revolution, there were all kinds of conspiracy theories. And then again, after World War I and the Russian Revolution, you got the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, because Europe had been traumatized by what had happened. After JFK, the assassination of JFK, which of course traumatized the United States, you had a whole wave of conspiracy theories. And now you're seeing it not only with 9/11, but you're seeing it with the 2008 financial crash. Any traumatized society which is grappling why bad things happen to good people will come to embrace conspiracy theories.
So are 9/11 conspiracy theories fundamentally different from other conspiracy theories, from JFK to the moon landing to, you know, President Obama's birth certificate and all the rest?
Well, as I argue in my book, Among the Truthers, the basic structure of conspiracy theories tends to be the same, a small group of evil people who are trying to take over the world. However, there are two things that make the 9/11 myths different. One is the extensive use of the Internet, which is a characteristic of all modern conspiracy theories. But 9/11 truth activists, as they call themselves, have made a particular fetish of using the Internet. The second aspect is the extraordinary emphasis on technical aspects of the conspiracy. This is especially the case since 2006, because there is an architect who James will know well. His name is Richard Gage. And he has made it his business to turn 9/11 conspiracy theories into a highly technical business. And if you Google his name on the internet, you'll find all sorts of diagrams, and he has a 600 PowerPoint slide presentation.
Okay, I'm just going to leave it there. Look, it's utter drivel. They use the internet. They have a fetish for using the internet. They're interested in technical information. I mean, yeah. Sure, they are, because, you know, these people like Richard Gage and Kevin Ryan, they're scientists, right? You know, that's what they do, is they look at technical information. And that's actually why they're not conspiracy theorists. Kevin Ryan and Richard Gage are not conspiracy theorists. They're only looking at the technical information because they're trying to look at the evidence, right? So what Jonathan Kay is saying is just completely nonsensical. It's a complete twist of logic and meanings and reality. And he says that, you know, this idea of the small group of people who conspires to do some terrible act. Well, that's actually the government's view. The government view is this small group of people, namely Osama bin Laden and his honchos, conspired to do this terrible act and had this amazing power. Gee, well, they were able to do it. They were able to fly the planes into the buildings. So what he ascribes to the conspiracy theorists is what the government actually says is the reality. Everything that Jonathan Kay says is a complete inversion of truth. The man is a pervert. The man is an insult to logic, an insult to reason. It just really makes me angry, I'm sorry to say. The man is a complete liar, a complete fake, a con man. And that is NPR Radio. Anyway, we're going to break. We'll be back with Ian Crane shortly.
Those headlines about global warming. The glaciers are melting. We're doomed. That's what several studies supposedly found. But other scientific studies found exactly the opposite. Greenland's glaciers are growing, not melting. The Antarctic ice sheet is getting thicker, not thinner. Did you see any big headlines about that? Why are they trying to scare us? Global warming alarmists claim the glaciers are melting because of carbon dioxide from the fuels we use. Let's force people to cut back, they say. But we depend on those fuels to grow our food, move our children, light up our lives. And as for carbon dioxide, it isn't smog or smoke. It's what we breathe out and plants breathe in. Carbon dioxide, they call it pollution. We call it life.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Welcome back to the show. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there is a conference coming up in Melbourne called Hidden Agenda 2012, and the keynote speaker at that conference will be Ian Crane. And just a little background here on Ian Crane. A former oilfield executive who has lived and worked in the Middle East, mainland Europe and the USA, Ian R. Crane has spent the last 13 years studying mythology, alternative history, ancient wisdom, secret societies, mysticism, and geopolitics. Ian has a unique take on many of the catastrophic events that have occurred in the first few years of the new millennium, where many only see more tragedy and suffering. Ian regards this period of history as the most exciting time since the days of Atlantis, and the eventual outcome, he says, is down to each and every one of us. Ian Crane, welcome to Truth News.
Hi, Harrowood. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. I mean, I only discovered you and your work recently. I was alerted to the conference, and I haven't really had a chance to study up on everything you do, but I understand that you've got a background in the oil industry, and that you are certainly a skeptic of the peak oil claims, which I've been myself a skeptic of for a long time, and I find that a really important subject, and I want to cover some of that with you while you're on. And of course, while you're here in Australia, you're going to be talking about the Australian economy and where the Australian economy sits in the overall kind of global economic meltdown that's now occurring. And I'm very interested to know your analysis of, you know, what role we've had to play in that, and what the future is for us here, because we have, as you were saying earlier off mic, basically the Australia has been very lucky so far. I mean, we're often called the lucky country, but we really have been very lucky. So Ian, I'll just hand it over to you. I mean, first of all, could we explore the concept of peak oil? Because many people who are listeners to this show, we have not actually done a show on it yet. We've done shows on a lot of topics, but I've never directly targeted the peak oil claims. And my view of it is simply that I can see that artificial scarcity is a way in which tyrannical governments and powers, and especially imperialistic powers, have always tried to consolidate their power by creating scarcity. And there are many examples of it in history. And the evidence, the actual factual evidence, is that there is just massive amounts of oil, and not so much a shortage, rather a glut. But over to you.
Okay. Hey, Harrowood. I think, based on the magnitude of the peak oil issue, we may actually have to run to a second show for some of the other topics.
Indeed.
Let's talk about peak oil, because you're right. It is a very, very important issue. And, let's start from the physical evidence, which you've just addressed. I mean, nobody has in recent history ever really felt the effects of a genuine shortage of hydrocarbon resources, right? I mean, basically, there was an artificially contrived shortage back in 1973, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But even though peak oil is, how should I say, certainly a big topic amongst very much the alternative community, there's no physical evidence to demonstrate that there really has been any shortage whatsoever. We've seen price manipulation, which is sometimes attributed to shortage, but that's not really true. So right. let's take a look. You're absolutely correct in your observation about the corporations absolutely benefiting from creating the perception of artificial scarcity. So whether there is a genuine scarcity or not, the corporations benefit, and even though there's no physical evidence of a shortage, if we have somewhere deep in our subconscious the germ of an idea that a particular product, particular commodity is in short supply, then we're quite happy it would seem, to pay an inordinate percentage of our hard-earned cash for that product or that commodity. And, you know, here we are today. I mean, oil is trading today. Actually, and we'll talk a bit more about this, I mean, oil right now is under $75 a barrel today.
Right.
And in the scheme of things, oil is incredibly cheap right now. When we look at the relationship to other commodities, particularly gold, which we'll certainly touch on. But the whole issue of oil really came into the global agenda in the early part of the 20th century or even late 19th century, when John D. Rockefeller instructed Henry Ford to stop manufacturing electric vehicles in 1896.
Wow.
It's staggering, isn't it?
I had no idea about that.
In the mid-1890s, there were 2,500 vehicles registered in what was then New York City. Obviously, it was nothing like the conurbation that it is today.
Right.
But of those 2,500 vehicles, 1,800 of them were electric. Now, you know, they didn't have great ranges, but they didn't need great ranges. You know, as long as a vehicle could sort of, you know, probably return maybe even 10, 15 miles, you know, between each charge, then that was sufficient for people to do their running around. You know, if they wanted to go any further, then they used the railroads or a horse and cart. But, you know, nonetheless, what it demonstrates is that, you know, nearly 120 years ago, the electric vehicle was actually dominant. But the Rockefellers and Standard Oil recognized the potential for selling hydrocarbons. And, of course, they certainly had the monopoly on it, really, at that time in the U.S. So they effectively instructed Henry Ford to stop building the electric car and to focus on petrol-driven vehicles. Through the early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s, the Rockefellers were buying up a lot of the electric tramways that were being had been built as the burgeoning sort of suburbia. In fact, suburbia came about not because of the motor car. Suburbia actually came about because of the electric trams that that cities had introduced in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Which were so incredibly efficient.
You start to get the idea here. You start to get the situation. And of course, navies were encouraged to move from coal-fired ships to oil-fired ships. So, you know, this was a very, very well thought out strategy by the early hydrocarbons industry.
And I just point out that Sydney had one of the most advanced tram networks in the world, and that was from, I believe, early in the 20th century. And we had all our tram networks ripped out. They were just physically ripped out of the ground in the 1960s, and everything was replaced with buses.
Yeah, and exactly. By the way, exactly the same in the UK.
Right.
I mean, London and many of the major cities in the UK, they had moved from trams. I mean, the trams were shut down in generally around the 1940s, 1950s, and replaced by electric trolley buses. And the electric trolley buses were remarkable. I mean, they had tremendous acceleration. I mean, obviously, the only limitation to them was where the overhead cables were laid. But likewise, about the same period, they were all ripped out and replaced, obviously, by the diesel-driven vehicles. So this was, you know, this was the global strategy. Now, the oil industry latched on to an individual's hypothesis, and that individual was a guy called Marion King Hubbard, who was a petroleum engineer, and he gave a presentation at a conference in 1957. The conference was, I believe, in Austin, Texas. Anyway, in this conference, he put forward the hypothesis, and it was a hypothesis based on, you know, some pretty flimsy geological data that was available back then. But he just presented this hypothesis, and he said, you know, we've got it real good in the US right now, but within 15 or so years, in fact, he said the early 70s, then the US is no longer going to be able to produce all the oil that it needs from within our borders. And And it was just left hanging there. But it was actually picked up by the global strategists because they started to be looking at how they could establish a global economy, how they could effectively make US products, and in particular arms, available to the rest of the world, and in particular to the developing world, and even more particular to the oil producing countries. So they actually created this opportunity.
Ian, we're just going to break. Really keen to continue with that absolutely fascinating stuff. So just bear with us and we'll have a quick break and be right back. I've got a song here by Elliot Smith. It's called Memory Lane.
Where you're dragged against your will from a basement on the hill. And all anybody knows is you're not like them. And they kick you in the head and send you back to bed. Isolation pulled you past the tunnel to a bright world where you can make a place to stay. But everybody's scared of this place and staying away. Your little house on memory lane. The mayor's name is Fear. His force patrols the pier from a mountain of cliché that advances every day. The doctor spoke a cloud. He rained out loud. You'll keep your doors and windows shut and swear you'll never show a soul again. But isolation pushes you till every muscle aches down the only road it ever takes. But everybody's scared of this place and staying away. Your little house on memory lane. If it's your decision to be open about yourself, be careful or else. Be careful or else. I'm comfortable apart. It's all written on my chart. And I take what's given me most cooperatively. I do what people say and lie in bed all day, absolutely horrified. I hope you're satisfied. Isolation pushes past self-hatred, guilt and shame to a place where suffering is just a game. But everybody's scared of this place and staying away. Your little house on memory lane. Your little house on memory lane.
Welcome back to the show. I'm here today with Ian Crane. And we are talking about peak oil. And I'm hearing some quite amazing facts that I was not aware of before about, in fact, that the electric car was around at the dawn of the motor vehicle industry and had to be basically extinguished. Because obviously it didn't allow those who wished to control and dominate to have enough power. I mean, would that be a fair way of describing it, Ian? That they basically, I mean, sure, there was some level of control and monopolization they could have through electricity, but nothing compared to being able to control the flow of oil, thereby controlling everything through oil.
Absolutely. And I mean, let's also, I mean, not forget, we'll touch more on this in a little while, but hydrocarbons today is the most efficient way of raising taxes after income tax. And that this is another primary reason for oil, one, being maintained at a high price, you know, this artificial scarcity being created to maintain that high price. But, you know, we've already got, we're going to talk about this maybe later, maybe in another show, but we're going to talk about, you know, the global economic meltdown. Well, you know, the global economic meltdown has occurred during a period of inordinately high hydrocarbon prices, when governments have had tremendous opportunity to rake in additional revenues from the higher prices of oil, and yet still, you know, with the possible exception of Australia, everywhere else in the developed world is going to hell in a handbasket as their economies disappear into an abyss. And all of this is, as I will demonstrate, is very, very carefully planned out. It's very carefully manipulated. It's a brilliant strategy. And they work on the basis. I mean, these guys, and I use the phrase, doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but, you know, those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of a planet, you know, they're not a Kabul from any one nation. They are transnationalists who, you know, have a passport by accident of birth, but they think globally, and they also think in very, very long term, you know, multi-generational plans in some cases. And they work on the basis that the vast majority of people, even if they have the interest and the inclination, don't have the time to actually research into the detail of this. And so, you know, they just carry on with their day-to-day lives. And these guys are able to put their plans, you know, into place almost unimpeded. So going back to the manipulation of oil, it's really kicked off in 1971 in a big way. It was Henry Kissinger and James A. Baker III. And between them, they effectively developed this strategy. I mean, Baker was steeped in oil. Kissinger, obviously, steeped in global strategy. Kissinger was the protege of a guy called Bernard Baruch, who was, you know, the primary global strategist of the early part of the 20th century. And Baruch trained two people to succeed him. And these are two people whose names, you know, we know very well today, Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Right.
Well, Kissinger and James A. Baker were working together in the late 60s, early 70s, and a big part of their longer-term strategy was to remove the U.S. dollar from the gold standard, which they did on August the 15th, 1971, where they persuaded Nixon to take the step of removing the dollar from the gold standard. Up until that point, any U.S. citizen or anybody else could turn up to a bank and in return for $35 be given an ounce of gold. And this was what effectively kept their economy in check. And this had been effectively established in the aftermath of the previous economic meltdown of 29 to 33. So gold was very much you know, the mainstay, the backbone, if you like, of economic stability. By removing it, then it opened up the market big time. Now, the next major part of the game here was to hike the price of oil, and also to bring out Marion King Hubbard's hypothesis and effectively tell the American people that we can't support ourselves. We haven't got enough oil to support ourselves. We're going to have to start importing oil. And the way in which they manipulated this in the next part of the game was through the Middle East crisis of 1973, Kissinger approached the head of OPEC, the oil-producing nations, who at the time was a guy called Sheikh Yamani of Saudi Arabia. And he proposed to Sheikh Yamani that OPEC use the Middle East crisis, because this was the time of the second Middle East war between the Arab nations and Israel, that they use this Middle East crisis to inflate the price of oil. And Sheikh Yamani said, but, you know, why? And Kissinger said, because we want to import more oil. But the kicker to this is that we want you, OPEC, to establish the petrodollar as the trading currency for oil. Now, Sheikh Yamani, you know, worked through this, and in fact, this is all very well described in Sheikh Yamani's autobiography. But Sheikh Yamani needed to get certainly the support of the then Shah of Iran. So he went to the Shah of Iran and told him that, you know, he'd come up with this great idea. claiming responsibility himself. And he said, you know, let's use the opportunity here of the Middle East crisis to increase the price of oil by 400%. And anyway, the Shah of Iran basically said, you know, we're never going to be able to do that. The Americans won't buy it. And Yamani tried to maintain that it was his idea for as long as he possibly could. But in the end, he had to say, look, we need to do this because the Americans have actually told us that they're willing to do this and they're willing to pay the price. And they want to buy a lot more. So this was the way in which the US actually was able to get US dollars into the global marketplace. I mean, they were giving Israel $3.6 billion a year, and they've maintained that number for a long time now. Sure. And they were giving Israel the money, but of course, and Israel then spends that money primarily on buying arms from the US. But Israel doesn't really have anything or any commodity that the US really needs, so they have to just give them the money. But the Arab nations and the other oil-producing countries, they do have something that America can use, i.e. it can buy in their oil and can then, you know, keep their own for strategic reserves. And,
yes, and
this was the real kicker. Of course, the Federal Reserve could simply print the money. So the Federal Reserve was certainly in this big time because the Federal Reserve would print the dollars, effectively, for the U.S. to then use to give to the OPEC countries, obviously in return for the oil. And the Federal Reserve was making out like a bandit because, of course, every dollar that the Federal Reserve was giving to the U.S. government to buy the oil was, of course, effective debt, which is why, you know, primarily why today the U.S. has, and you know, what's in the public domain is that the U.S. has a debt of close on $14 trillion. And, you know, much of this has been, you know, building up, not just because of the wars, but because the U.S. has been, the U.S. government has been borrowing dollars from the Federal Reserve to buy this this oil. And of course, what it's been doing is it's been putting money into all of the Arab countries and other oil producing countries, and then those countries have been using that money to effectively buy products from the US. And unfortunately, those products have ostensibly been military products and weaponry. So you see how all this manipulation really starts to come back, because this 1973, this was really the start of the establishing the global economy.
And that's, you know, what they call
the clock forward.
The energy crisis. There was a mini crisis that they called the energy crisis at that time. And that, so you're saying that was
a
manufactured thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In the UK, although we never used them, but in early 1974, everybody was actually issued with petrol ration coupons.
My God.
They were never actually were used. But you see, this was an important part. It was a very important part of the mindscaping of the people, because that was the period when the price of oil really started to ramp up. And actually, you know, another thing was that was also the period at which the UK went from imperial measures to metric measures.
Right.
So, you know, it was remarkable how at that period, price of gasoline at the pumps, instead of being sold by the gallon, was then sold by the litre. And so, you know, they took that opportunity to hike the price really dramatically, which of course was reflected in the sort of the charge of a barrel of oil anyway, which had been put up by 400%. But it meant that the, you know, a lot of the people, they didn't really make the connect, because what they saw on the price of the pump was less than what they'd seen previously. But of course, they were barely getting a quarter for the new figure, because it was a litre, compared to the gallon they were getting previously. Is this all part of the manipulation process?
I'm just going to question, Ian, in regard to America, was there a time when the United States could supply its own oil needs? I mean, and it, to what degree did that change over time? I mean, obviously now it almost all comes from overseas. Are you saying like before the 1970s, a large amount of American oil was coming from American oil fields?
In my opinion, I mean, you know, let's also understand America's consumption, because America today accounts, this is the USA, purely the USA. The USA today accounts for close on 24% of total global hydrocarbon production. I mean, it's an astronomical number.
Right.
So the global production is around about 90 million barrels a day, of which the U.S. consumes basically about 20 million.
Right, right. Okay, we've just got another break coming up. I'd like to try, we've got one more segment in the show. I'd like to cover a bit more of the Australian stuff that you're going to be talking about at the conference and wrap up on the oil. This is really, really amazing information you're giving us tonight. Thanks so much.
This is Building 7, a 47-story skyscraper that fell on the afternoon of September 11th.
The government says that fire brought it down. However, 1,500 architects and engineers concluded it was a controlled demolition.
Over 6,000 of my fellow service members have given their lives.
And thousands of my fellow first responders are dying.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I'm a structural engineer.
I'm a New York City correction officer.
I'm an Air Force pilot.
I'm a father who lost his son.
We're Americans, and we deserve the truth.
Go to rememberbuilding7.org today.
Sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back. I'm here tonight with Ian Crane, who's an expert in oil politics and geopolitics. And Ian, you've just been going through there some of the ways in which the oil has been the oil crisis and crises have been manipulated. And that last point you made, could you just repeat that again? That the percentage of production from the US.
Well, the total production, total global production, is a little shy of 90 million barrels a day, and the U.S. basically consumes around about 20 million barrels a day.
Right.
So, I mean, the U.S. Consumption is a little over about 22-23% of total global production.
That is staggering in itself. Yeah.
It is staggering, isn't it? It is absolutely staggering. And in my opinion, it is my opinion. That I mean, the U.S. has had the capability to produce a much higher percentage of its own resources, and not necessarily 100%, but certainly a much higher percentage than it has. But it's been holding back, and the reason it's been holding back is because it's using the opportunity to, one, import oil from other countries, thereby keeping its own for strategic reserves, but more importantly, it's been buying in the oil from overseas because it's been able to put the petrodollar into the global market, and this is a big part of the globalization strategy. So,
okay.
And then, by the way, let me make it very, very clear: I am absolutely not an advocate of maintaining production of 90 million barrels a day. You know, although I spent almost 20 years in the oil industry, you know, working all around the world, I am absolutely of the opinion that the alternatives to hydrocarbons have basically been around pretty much forever.
Yeah.
It's a strategy. It's a deliberate corporate strategy to maintain a global reliance on hydrocarbons, because it is the corporations, of course, and the governments through taxation who benefit. The alternatives are being suppressed, basically. And in many cases, the patents for the alternatives are bought up and then buried by the oil companies themselves, so that they can maintain their monopolistic hold on our energy source.
Can I just get a quick heads up from you on what you think the impact of a carbon tax will be on that? Because the carbon tax purports to be a way to move the economy away from hydrocarbons. What do you think about that?
Okay, the carbon tax is a con. And in fact, the reason that attention has been focused on Australia is because of the belief that the Australian people are going to be the easiest to be able to manipulate into establishing the carbon tax. Now, the game plan was to introduce it globally up until December 2009, when something very, very significant occurred. In fact, I recorded a presentation in, I think it was November of 2009, called The Green Agenda and Population Reduction, where I was explaining how the green movement, the whole green political movement, had been hijacked and was being effectively manipulated into supporting policies and philosophies to enable the, you know, the ruling elite, if you like, to get in their carbon trading agenda, which was going to be the foundation for establishing global governance. And this was going to be the primary purpose of the Copenhagen summit in December 2009. But just a few weeks before that summit, something that nobody could have predicted occurred. The ClimateGate emails were released. And the ClimateGate emails basically prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the whole of the climate change, global warming, carbon agenda is a political construct. In fact, we can actually trace in some of their own documents. I mean, way back in the 1960s, we see in the report from Iron Mountain the talk of using the threat of environmental pollution and global warming to maintain fear, to effectively use that as an alternative to the Cold War. And they acknowledge in that document, which came into the public domain in 1967, they actually acknowledge that it would take a generation to a generation and a half before the global warming agenda, the mythology, actually had any traction amongst the public. And the that document was, not, I won't say plagiarized, but it was certainly rephrased in another document published by the Club of Rome in the early 1990s. So, and let me tell you that there is an Australian physics professor who, in my opinion, has produced the most outstanding analysis of the ClimateGate emails. And that's a guy called Professor John P. Costella. And the document that he produced, and he published it early in 2010, it's called The ClimateGate Analysis. And anybody Googling ClimateGate Analysis, John P. Costella, or going to the website Assassination Science, all one word, assassinationscience.com, can download John P. Costella's analysis of the ClimateGate emails. And I mean, right now, with Julia Gillard, who has been set up, Julia Gillard has been set up, I mean, she's the puppet in this, to try and introduce the carbon tax system in Australia, because in the US and in Europe, nobody who is capable of critical thought believes in the global warming, you know, the threat of the carbon gases. I mean, it's a ridiculous hypothesis anyway when you think about it, but
yeah,
nobody in the US or Europe, or certainly not enough people, believe it for it to have any kind of political traction. And that's why they've turned their attention to Australia. Because Australia is now basically the template for bringing in the carbon trading economy. And, you know, the bottom line is that hopefully that, you know, the Australian people will realize that Julia Gillard, who, of course, before she became prime minister, and yet again, you know, in Australia, just like in the UK, when we had Gordon Brown, you have an unelected prime minister. I mean, she got there because obviously Kevin Rudd stood down.
She got there because Kevin Rudd stood down, and then she was re-elected because she lied,
essentially
broke her pledge that there would be no carbon tax, because the government had become massively unpopular under Kevin Rudd, mainly because of the ETS, when there was this leadership shuffle, one of the first things she said is there will be no carbon tax under a government I lead. And she
went
to the election on that. And then she won the election. And 3 weeks later, she completely reversed the position.
Exactly. She did a complete 180. I mean, she's a fully paid up member of the Fabian Society, and you know, this has been the Fabians have been, you know, behind this carbon trading agenda for a long, long time. They realize that they've lost the battle in the US. They've lost the battle in Europe. The only place where they think they've got a chance of getting it put into place is Australia. And let me tell you, you know, the problem is that, like I said, there are very few people who have the time, even if they have an inclination, to research this stuff. And so consequently, I mean, I produced a DVD called Peak Oil, Myth or Reality, some 4 years ago. And that was before the price of oil hiked up to $147 in the middle of 2008 and then dumped, just like I predicted it would. It dumped from 147 down to 35 because the global economy cannot, you know, pay. Well, at the time, it was paying 7% of GDP for its basic hydrocarbons, and it can't survive on that.
Right.
And so it fell right down to $35. Over the last decade, oil has averaged, a barrel of oil has averaged at 7.2% of an ounce of gold. Now, you know, what should be concerning people watching the global economy from Australia, you know, they should be looking at what's going on with the price of gold, because over, you know, the past, in November of 2008, the price of an ounce of gold was $775 an ounce. You know, the gold trading closed on Friday evening at $1,788 an ounce. So gold has increased in value by over $1,000 an ounce in less than 3 years. So, you know, people need to be watching what's going on in the global economy, because let me tell you, you know, what's happening in Australia right now is, I believe that the economy in Australia is being maintained artificially, and it will be maintained until such time as Julia Gillard railroads her carbon trading proposition through, and then the economy in Australia will go the same way as in the US and in Europe, and the rug will be pulled from under it. And by the way, on the broader scheme of things, because of a much wider agenda, they absolutely have to do this before the end of 2012. And I think that Australia has basically got one more year at best of financial buoyancy, encouraging people to borrow more and more, all on the basis that, you know, the economy's fantastic, days of boom and bust are over, just keep borrowing. Buy a second house, buy a second car, upgrade to a bigger house, just get a bigger mortgage. And of course, mortgage means death grip, mortgage, death grip.
Sure.
You know, and once they've got individuals, businesses, and governments into enough debt, then they'll pull the rug. And that's coming. It's coming down the tracks like a steam train.
So Just to recap there, going back to what you were saying earlier about hydrocarbons, and that, you know, that there are better solutions, there are better ways of providing energy. And the people who are, I guess, believe the concept of what a carbon tax is supposed to be there for, have been conned into thinking that this carbon tax is the way to achieve that. Because, I mean, but I guess what we can all agree on, even the you know, the Greens and us can agree, well, yes, we are too reliant on oil, and it's not a great you know, there are a lot of problems with it, but the solution that is being proposed is not what it seems to be. But what is it?
Absolutely.
What actually is it? I mean, what are they trying to achieve?
What is being proposed here? What is being proposed is going to actually, even more than now, accelerate the transfer of wealth. It's going to accelerate the transfer of wealth from the individual to a much smaller group of individuals and the corporations. You know, and this is what has been going on now for best part of a couple of decades, and you know, what we see it right throughout the world is that the global wealth is migrating towards a smaller and smaller number of people, and the debt, the magnitude of debt, is being pushed out to a wider and wider tranche of people, so that, you know, people at the lower end of society, if you like, either live literally day to day or they've created the capacity to be able to borrow more based on prospective future earnings. So more and more people are actually sort of maintaining their existing lifestyle through extending their debt profile. You know, this is not sustainable. And carbon trading is certainly going to make the likes of Al Gore. I mean, when Al Gore left office, when he left, when he effectively conceded the presidency to George W. Bush in December of 2000, his recorded assets were barely $2 million. Because he's become the focal point for the carbon trading movement, which is all based around, obviously, you know, the fake and false ecological movement related to global warming, that turned his barely $2 million into $200 million. When carbon trading becomes established, even if it's just in Australia, Al Gore will become a trillionaire.
Extraordinary. So he has positioned himself well. He's part of the ruling elite. I mean, obviously, these people who are benefiting from it are a very, very tiny handful of people, and most of them are people we probably don't know and will never know. We haven't got a lot of time left, but I mean, can you just in a couple of minutes just run through what the scenario is in your opinion that this ruling elite wants to achieve? I mean, are we looking at a totalitarian one world government with a population reduction scenario like Alex Jones and other people have been talking about that we're going to be,
absolutely.
You know,
I mean,
culling
look, it's spelt
the
out in tablets of stone. I mean, anybody who hasn't visited the Georgia Guidestones, then you know, please do so on Google, and go take a look at the Georgia Guidestones, and you look at the goals and objectives of the New World Order that were put up there on this phenomenal henge, this stone henge. In 1982, the 10 goals and objectives, and number one is reduce the population to under 500 million. This is global population to under 500 million in balance with nature. To, like you said, we've only got a couple of minutes left. So to put it in a nutshell, this new world order, this global government, and in fact, global government is a misnomer, because what these guys are actually trying to achieve, and they're well on the way to doing it, is a global corporation. I mean, the governments, all of the governments will simply be charades. They'll be effective parodies of democracy to sort of still create the illusion that the people have some participation in the political process. But in reality, just like we see in the US, increasingly in Europe, it is the corporations who own the politicians. I mean, you know, Julia Gillard, what happened? What happened? Why did she do her 180? You know, is she just so shallow that she did it purely because she lied purely because she knew she had to lie to be able to get into the office? Or did somebody spell out the facts of life to her that, you know, basically she needed to come on board here if she wanted to, you know, maintain the title and all the benefits that go with the office? And unfortunately, this is, of course, increasingly what happens. Many politicians go into politics with the best of intentions, but once they realize that their lifestyle can be can benefit dramatically by getting into bed with the corporations and effectively becoming, you know, the representatives of the corporations, then, you know, they sell their soul. And I don't think Julia Gillard is really any different here. We saw it with Tony Blair. We're seeing it now in the UK with David Cameron. These guys are not only selling their own soul, they're selling the soul of the nation. I mean, we saw it in Ireland. I mean, the Ireland economy is a basket case, because the former head of the World Trade Organization, Peter Sutherland, effectively instructed the then Prime Minister, Brian Cowen, and his Chancellor, Brian Lenihan, to literally underwrite all of the Irish banks' debts with taxpayer funding. And that destroyed the Irish economy in a heartbeat. And the only reason they can have done that is because of the pressure that comes from the elite who think they are the rightful rulers of the planet. But, you know, what is happening here? They know very well, Hereward, that they're starting to run into some problems. And these problems are primarily caused by more and more people realizing what's going on. In fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote a book in 1969, published in 1970, called Between Two Ages, The Technotronic Era. Absolutely essential reading for everybody who is interested in this subject, because that book, 40 years old now, is ostensibly the template for everything that's occurring right now. But in that book, Zbigniew Brzezinski makes the observation, and he says that one of the challenges for Western governments will be to keep their people locked into consumerist materialism, preventing them from realizing who they truly are. That same man, Zbigniew Brzezinski, on May the 15th last year, before the Council on Foreign Relations, made a statement, and he said the biggest obstacle to establishing the one world government is the rapid political awakening of the masses.
Ian, we're going to have to leave it there. That was superb. I'd like to get you on again while you're in Australia. I know you're coming to Sydney soon. We're going to have the links on our site. I'd really like to get you on for another show. This has been really excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harrowwood.
Talk to you again. Thank you. That's another show from Truth News Radio Australia, and I hope you enjoyed that. It was quite insightful. We'll be back next week.